Welcome to Conversatio, the Belmont Abbey podcast. This podcast aims to form and transform our community so that each of us can reflect God's image. I'm Dr. Daniel Kling, Assistant Professor of Finance at Belmont Abbey College, and I'm your host for today's episode. And today I'm joined by Dr. Hannah Kling, one of my favorite economists and my wife. And she's the Assistant Professor of Economics and Data Analytics at Belmont Abbey College. And we're excited to talk about the dynamics of state population growth based on some research Hannah recently published with the Mackinac Center, a state-based think tank in Michigan. But before we dive in, I'll let Hannah introduce herself. Hannah?
Yeah, so I'm Assistant Professor of Economics and Data Analytics here at Belmont Abbey College, and we've been here together for 5 years now, which is crazy to think about.
Yeah.
I got my PhD in economics from George Mason University in 2017, and my primary areas of research are regional economics, studying the flow of people and economic goods across space, and thinking about the role of place, and also thinking about the interplay of politics and economics, which in economics we call public choice economics.
Great. So you wrote a paper about what research can tell us about population growth in states, and you're working with an organization in Michigan, and they're concerned there because the population has been declining. But it's sort of a broadly applicable topic because we all care about whether, you know, where we live, if it grows or shrinks, how it changes over time. And so there's some interesting parallels, especially here in North Carolina, where we've had significant population growth. So to sort of set up the topic, can you summarize your research? What were the main factors that affect population growth?
Yeah, so people care about population growth both because economic well-being comes from a lot of people being together and interacting a lot. But so population growth can be helpful in making, you know, more job opportunities and you know, having enough demand to have cool restaurants and things like that. But also just if people are coming into your area, that's sort of an indicator that you have a nice, appealing place. So it's both helpful, but also kind of an indicator that you're doing something right. And when we talk about population growth, there are kind of four main sources of population growth. There are births. So, you know, we've got three kids, so yeah. we've done our part to help North Carolina's population. there's deaths. There's domestic migration, so people moving here from elsewhere in the United States, so other states, and then international migration as well, so people coming here from other countries. So each of those four sources of population growth are influenced by a number of different factors.
And so I think in most places there's more births than deaths, although that's sort of its own broad concern of what's the replacement rate and how many kids are people having. And then I guess from state to state, the bigger difference is the domestic migration, whether people are moving into your state or moving out of your state. And so is that the same situation in Michigan, what you found? Was that migration was the big driver there?
Yeah, so the birth rate, the death rate, and international migration don't vary as much as domestic migration does, although certain states tend to have more older people, so their death rates tend to be higher and birth rates tend to be lower. But also when you think about policies that are aimed at increasing or having population growth, there is some research and literature, and I reviewed that in my paper on, you know, things that can impact the birth rate or the death rate, or international migration isn't something that states have as much control over since it's more federal policy. So when people talk about increasing population growth in their state from a policy perspective, most of the time they're thinking about how to make your place more appealing to attract people from other states.
And that's really familiar to me. So I grew up in Missouri in a small town, and there wasn't a lot, you know, there was always a constant thing. How can we revitalize the town? How can we make this place, you know, grow again like it did when I was when my grandparents were kids or whatever. And the Rust Belt and the Northeast sort of dust, it's sort of a familiar story of a declining population. And so it's not a new thing that states are dealing with, but so what are some policies that people have tried to foster growth, to help get people to move back to this area or not move away from this area, from a given area.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the things people think of is mm-hmm. they try to think of places that are thriving and growing, mm-hmm. and they want to mimic that in their particular area. So, oh, you know, this town that's so cool, this city that's so cool, and all the young people want to go be there. It has all these places where the shops are on the bottom floor. There's a bunch of apartments above there. So you know what we need to do? We need to just make our town look like this. And it's sort of like, you know, in high school when it's, oh, how do I get the cool kids to come sit at my table? Like, what are things like at their table? And you try to make it look like that. You try to be cool, but I don't know what your experience was, honey, but I mean, it's just...
I was very cool in high school.
That's right. That's right.
Don't ask any of my high school friends that don't check.
That's right. I mean, you can be, you know, your mother, I'm sure, told you that you can be a first-rate version of yourself or a second-rate version of somebody else. So copying what's successful is really appealing, but that doesn't tend to work super well. That policy area is called placemaking, and there's a lot of research into that.
So we're gonna lure the cool kids here by looking. I feel like you have some places in mind with that.
Oh yeah, you know your Austins, your Bostons.
I guess Nashville and places where they like. Yep. Oh, we got to hit Instagram things, so maybe we really need some cool murals.
That's right.
Because people come here and look at the cool murals. So
yes.
If we get murals, we'll get people.
That's right.
And so that doesn't work. You're saying.
Well, let's give it a try.
Okay. Maybe this has never worked.
That's our takeaway for today. It's
okay.
Murals. Yes.
We need to just make this look cool. So so what happens when people try to do that, or why is that not successful, or do we know?
Right. So one of the things as economists that, as you know, makes people dislike economists is whenever somebody has a good idea, we've got a good reason why it's not going to work, and it's going to be not worth it. Okay. And that it not being worth it, I think, is what the economists always bring to the table, is there's a trade-off, there's a cost to everything. Mm-hmm. If we're investing resources, you know, at the governmental level, on doing a particular thing, we've got fewer resources to do something else.
Okay.
And especially if we're investing resources in making a particular place more appealing to outside residents, that means that we are taxing or imposing on the original residents in order to make things more attractive for the cool kids.
Okay, and they get to choose wherever they want to go. It may not, why would we subsidize them? But it kind of reminds me of how cities, like, again, where I was growing up, there was always sort of like, oh, we can just get this company to build a factory here, and let's lure some corporate investment here. That's another way they kind of try to bid for growth, is we'll give a tax break to this developer or that developer, sort of industrial policy at the state level. Does that tend to be successful, or how does that, what are the dynamics there?
Well, as we know from our experience in Wisconsin, whenever there's a company that says, oh, hey, we're going to, you know, open a factory, it's going to employ 5,000 local people, who wants us to come there? Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, oh, you know, you should come here. Well, how do localities compete for that company to locate there? They compete through providing subsidies, tax incentives, and all kinds of things to lure that company there. And whoever is the highest bidder, you know, spends almost as much as the factory is going to bring in order to get that company to come there. And then, you know, sometimes the company is successful, but sometimes it, you know, goes belly up shortly after coming and, you know, reorganizing everything and taking a bunch of subsidies. And sometimes, in fact, it never even opens. So
take the money, run. Thanks for going to all that trouble. We're just, you know, we're going to,
right.
we'll
should,
see you later.
We should figure out how to do this.
It seems like good business to be in. Just get some subsidies and don't even
right.
show up.
That's
probably. We'll see. We'll see. We'll talk about it off. Yeah. So.
Right.
Those haven't tended to be successful. What about things like, I remember there a while ago Google had Google Fiber, and they're going to have really fast internet service. And I mean, if you're our age, the economic story of our lifetime has kind of been this giant tech boom. That you know, Apple and Microsoft and Google, all of these companies, Silicon Valley, Washington, kind of up and down the Pacific Coast, have been very successful, lots of jobs, lots of growth in those areas. And so Google had, we're going to bring fast internet, and countries or cities all across the country, states all across the country, were trying to lure Google there, not with necessarily subsidies, but the thing I remember from it was Topeka changed their name to Google Kansas for a week, and they didn't even go to Topeka. But so how about that? How about like chasing something that's working in the economy, like getting more tech jobs or tech incubators or startups and that kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm. Well, the research shows that trying to chase whatever is the fastest growing industry nationally is not as important or successful as doing what you do better than anybody else. And sometimes that's going to require a big change, you know. Michigan, traditionally, mm-hmm. auto manufacturing, mm-hmm. you know, they've got to branch out and do something else really well. But the tech thing is, you know, always on everyone's mind as the big growth area. But to use a Pacific Coast analogy, it's sort of like you're out there waiting on your surfboard. You see the wave go by. That's the big wave of the future. And mm-hmm. by the time you see that it is big and that a bunch of other surfers are on the wave, it has passed you by. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the research shows that chasing highly successful industries mm-hmm. as a state, and this is thinking about trying to do that as a state, not as an entrepreneur, but mm-hmm. as a state, changing something about your infrastructure, your tax code, your regulations, in order to try to attract a particular kind of business, mm-hmm. that just does not tend to be super successful.
So I think another trend we've seen is sort of, we need to teach all of our kids how to code. Right, education is another policy that might affect this. If we teach all of our kids how to code, we could be the next Silicon Valley. That you're saying that's not necessarily going to work because the chance to do that was 20 years before you knew you were supposed to do it.
I mean, if people want to teach kids how to code, I'm sure that would be great. But also math, you know, mm-hmm. math and reading skills also super important.
Right, and those could be valuable no matter what you're doing.
Yeah, so the research shows that having high quality education mm-hmm. is a big draw for people to move into a particular state. But also, on the other hand, high taxes are a deterrent.
Okay.
So really what we're looking for is not spending a lot on education per se, but getting a large return on whatever amount we spend on education. So spending wisely, whether we spend a lot or a little, is really the goal with education. And that's a whole different, how to do education right is not the
simple, subject. Simple, just do everything right and don't waste
that's right.
your money. Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
Just like parenting, super simple.
Very simple, yeah. Just don't make wrong decisions.
That's right.
And never have, which don't plan to.
No.
So I guess that's interesting though, because I guess there's also a link that we sort of know from research that just spending money on education, regardless of the tax impact, may not actually improve the education, right? That it's difficult to know, and it sort of hearing you say that, it's sort of like well, you want to spend your money well, regardless of the effect on population growth. You kind of just want to be doing that well in the first place. And if it was that easy, then you'd be, right? It's not like if not for population growth, I'd want to waste my money, and so it's sort of that's the public choice economics that is not easy, I suppose. Have there been any strategies that have been successful in fostering sustainable growth or thinking about sort of new growth versus revitalization? Why are these now struggling cities, why were they so big in the first place? Or is there, I don't know, how does that all relate?
Yeah, so what makes a place successful is a huge area of economic study
right.
of urban economics, which mm-hmm. is a sub of regional economics, which is part of what I do. And that's one of our big questions. But the kind of notion behind a city thriving is that there's something called agglomeration economies, mm-hmm. where when you get a bunch of people together, they're more productive than, you know, when they're far apart from each other.
So the whole is greater than just the sum of the parts.
Correct.
Right? Yeah.
So they share knowledge and ideas and things grow. Silicon Valley is a great example of this. Mm-hmm. And one of the best urban economists, Ed Glaser, has written quite a few papers in this. So my paper that I wrote was a review of mm-hmm. all the current literature on the idea of state population growth. And one of his articles is Why the Death of Distance Helped New York and Hurt Detroit. So what's the death of distance?
I was gonna say yes.
The death of distance is that, you know, especially now, but this was written, I think, pre-COVID. But, you know, you can telecommute, there's, the economy is global, communication is global and extremely cheap. I mean, when we were growing up, it was,
long distance calls
were expensive,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
And when we got cell phones, it was like, well, long distance calls are free, like in the evening,
right?
Yeah.
And you really need to tell grandma you love her before 7 p.m., you know?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So communication has gotten extremely cheap, even though we tend to think of it as having been free forever, but it had like, it's a very recent thing. So the death of distance is that idea that there's nothing to say that two people on opposite sides of the country can't collaborate just as easily as people next door to each other. But instead we find that some cities are growing larger, that being in proximity to other people has gotten more important and more economically beneficial than it used to be if you're in certain types of industries related to service, innovation, and you know, technology and things like that. So those types of things helped cities based on certain industries like New York's industries, whereas manufacturing, Detroit and other cities were hurt by the death of distance. Super cheap to ship stuff all over the world.
So that's sort of, if you're doing finance or advertising or politics or media or whatever in New York, there's a benefit to being all, with all of those people, and you can hire people from different companies and the expertise is there. But in Detroit, the ability to have a factory here and a factory there, I don't need to be physically close to your factory over there to manage it if I, the way I would have needed to back when long distance calls were a thing, as opposed to just pick up the phone or an email or whatever.
Right. So the challenge for all the Rust Belt cities is finding something else to do that's their, what we call in economics, their comparative advantage, right? You don't have to be better absolutely than somebody else, but you have to be comparatively better. And I guess listeners can, you know, audit our intro econ class to learn more about that. But yeah, the basic idea is everybody does better if all areas and all people are focusing on the things that they do best.
So grow wheat where it's good to grow wheat, or mine where there's mountains and minerals, or what, I don't know much about mining, I suppose, but yeah, presumably there's places that are better for it than others.
Make furniture in North Carolina for some reason.
Well, that's interesting that some reason you mentioned, because it's sort of like, you've told me about this, how a lot of early development was basically around rivers and railroads and like how far up the river can you get, because trade meant putting stuff on a boat. And that's less, I mean, we still do a lot of shipping, you know, on ships, I suppose. But it's, I guess it's less important to be on a river or at a crossroads of rivers like than it would have been 100 years ago. And so if a city's original growth was from that, then I guess it's interesting to think about, well, the reason you're, you know, Cleveland or I don't know which cities are river-based necessarily, Chicago, I suppose, St. Louis, like, if that reason is no longer as dominant as it was, like, you almost have to invent something new if you want the city to be big and to grow, would you say?
Yeah, so there's this idea in economic history, which is another of my favorite fields, about persistence, what makes cities persist. And part of it is once you get kind of a critical mass of people there for originally for reasons of river access and stuff like that, once you get a bunch of people together, then you have those agglomeration economies kicking in where people interacting and working together become more productive. And you don't, you know, if the river dried up and went away, like you'd still you'd still have that critical mass of people interacting with each other. So it just depends on whether the city can continue to pursue what works for them. But you had asked what policies tend to work. And the really tough thing with that is there's no magical thing that's going to guarantee that your city is young and hip and thriving and innovative. What you can do is use policies to make pretty sure that's not going to happen.
Right.
So you can prevent it from happening, okay, but you can't make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the best thing that mm-hmm. cities can do mm-hmm. is help entrepreneurs be able to open there. So reduce regulations that prevent people from starting businesses and mm-hmm. just basically set up a good environment mm-hmm. for things to grow, lower crime, good rule of law and things mm-hmm. like that, mm-hmm. which most states in the US don't have a huge struggle with that, with, corruption and fraud, but I mean, we do.
Not zero. There's a difference between states and how well they use their money. And
right. Right. So, you want low taxes, low barriers to entry. Let people come in and try new businesses mm-hmm. and make that more possible, and you're going to get more innovation that way. But mm-hmm. it's sort of like, it's like being a gardener. You can make the ground as perfect as you can, you water, you fertilize and all those things, but it's sometimes the seeds grow and sometimes they don't.
Right.
Yeah. Our son Matthias just the other day there was a daffodil that was mm-hmm. about to bloom, and he's like, "Can I make it bloom?" He's like, "Gonna open the bud," and you can't force it.
Right.
You can't force it. All you can do is
prevent it from blooming
if you rip it open.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess sometimes we see that, right? That the cities and the states are sort of blocking development, but they could at least not stop doing that,
right.
But that doesn't guarantee that now it will. Yeah. Okay. So I guess sort of I want to kind of bring this all a little bit closer to home, because here in North Carolina it is a different story, and I was looking at the numbers, and our state's growing about 50% faster than the U.S. average, about 1% a year, and we have more births than deaths in North Carolina, and there's some international migration, although a little less than average, but the big driver is that people are moving here from other states. In 2019. The North Carolina population increased by about 110,000 people, and 2/3 of that was from domestic migration. So, including us, right? We moved here with our then 2-year-old son, and so why is the situation in North Carolina so different from Michigan? Is it the weather? I mean, I like not having to shovel snow, but
yeah. So the research actually shows that mm-hmm. weather doesn't matter quite so much, and also to the extent weather does matter, mm-hmm. people seek more temperate areas. So North Carolina's summers I wouldn't describe as temperate. But
yeah.
So the weather of a particular place just falls into a broad category of draws or attractors mm-hmm. that we call amenities. Mm-hmm. There are natural amenities such as, mountains and beaches and rivers and good weather. Mm-hmm. And then there are, consumption amenities.
Cultural amenities.
So theater and symphony and things like that. And then there's, retail and restaurant amenities. Mm-hmm. Transportation infrastructure can be seen as kind of an amenity. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, what are nice things? What go in the pros column
right.
about living someplace other than the job opportunity and the monetary compensation. Mm-hmm. So most people move for a job,
right.
but is it worth it to us to move to San Francisco? Like, you gotta look, cost of living,
right.
amenities, you're thinking about all those things, not just the money, but how nice is it to live in a particular place? And Belmont, North Carolina is pretty nice.
It is very, very nice, yeah. But I guess it's sort of interesting because there's a sense that some people would then prefer not to have so much population growth, right? You bring up San Francisco, and it's extraordinarily expensive there. And if someone announced, oh, we're hiring 1,000 new workers here, everyone would groan and say, oh, there's gonna be more competition for our housing, and rent's just gonna go up and housing prices will go up. And so how can we kind of reconcile that desire for, we want our state to be growing, we don't want to be shrinking at least, but we also, people are conflicted when they have, they're going to build a new subdivision just down the street. How do we kind of balance those?
Yeah, so there's always, we're people who've recently come in, so we can't.
As people who have recently moved here, how do you
right.
feel about people who move here?
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
But people very quickly become mm-hmm. put themselves in the other column. They're mm-hmm. like, oh, I'm here now.
Okay.
So, I'm playing with the bouncy ball. You can't have it.
Right, I got it first, so therefore I have a right to it. I've heard that somewhere before.
That's right. Yeah. We might hear that when we go home.
And,
yeah. Our children playing, so you know, nicely with each other.
Right.
But no. So there's the current residents are always like, I just slipped in before mm-hmm. housing prices rose, and you know, now I want to freeze everything because mm-hmm. I like my neighborhood the way it is. I like everything close to me the way it is. Mm-hmm. Although I do wish, you know, there were more people who wanted an Ethiopian restaurant in downtown Belmont.
It would be lovely. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's make it happen. So if there's more people, you've got more demand for the things mm-hmm. that you want. And more tax base for things that you want your local government to do and supply. Mm-hmm. But also, yeah, people are like, I don't want the single family house next door turning into a duplex or a, you know, small mm-hmm. apartment with
or
four
giant
or
skyscraper or who knows.
Or who knows what, So.
Well, so it's interesting. So you're kind of talking about some of the benefits of having more people that move in here, move near you, right? Better. More tax base, more just demand for things you might like. And then we think about the externalities, right? What are the drawbacks to having more people come? And I guess higher prices is kind of a mixed blessing. If you bought a house, then I wouldn't mind higher prices. But then what other externalities are affected by population growth? Or how does more people coming in kind of affect us negatively?
I mean, the two big ones are mm-hmm. the strain on the traffic infrastructure mm-hmm. and the strain on other infrastructure of, you know, electricity and water and mm-hmm. and the utilities. That's the word I'm looking for.
So infrastructure, and then I guess social services might be a thing, right? The schools are so crowded. Presumably you could build another school, but sometimes that's easier said than done or it takes longer than you'd like it to. And so I guess how do we sort of, one of the things that I think we want to talk about on this podcast is sort of the Benedictine hallmarks and the idea of stewardship and hospitality and community. And some bigger questions about like, what does it mean to be a good place? Or what should be the goal of local governance in terms of balancing people who are here or people who might want to come here? How do you sort of put all those together?
Yeah, so sometimes those can seem a little bit in conflict sometimes, mm-hmm. you know. Hospitality, you should, you know, welcome everyone in and give them as much surplus and extra mm-hmm. as you can. Mm-hmm. But then, we want to keep our community kind of the same maybe. But we want to be good stewards of the space that we have. You know, mm-hmm. we don't want to cut down all the trees and things like that. But I think the hospitality and the community are really, you've got to think about what, like you were saying, what makes the people that are currently there more important than the people who might come into a particular area. And change is inevitable. You know, if we don't build any additional housing, mm-hmm. the single family houses in our neighborhood mm-hmm. are going to become too expensive for families with young kids to live in. And
right.
it's going to be, you know, groups of, you know, single people who work in Charlotte who, mm-hmm. you know, live in the house in the suburbs mm-hmm. and have their Maseratis in the driveway. And where are all the families with the kids? You're going to price the people that you're used to having there out of the market. And there's inevitably going to be change. Mm-hmm. And there can be kind of a sense that these hallmarks can be a little bit hard
of conflict
to think
there.
About.
Yeah, I mean, when you were talking about that, I was reminded of the Lorax, the Dr. Seuss book, where they, you know, cut down all the trees and the sort of dystopian metropolis thing. And it sort of sometimes feels like, oh, that's what development is going to be. Everywhere is going to be skyscrapers and highways. But there's then sort of you balance, and that doesn't seem like good stewardship of the land or the environment. But then there's sort of an inevitability to it that if you can't build some apartments and skyscrapers somewhere, then you just keep sprawling out. So now four people have to share a house instead of just four people living in four apartments. And so it's an interesting, I mean, it's sort of an interesting balance that, I don't know, it's I guess there's not an answer. I guess that's kind of one of my, sort of would be my next question there, is sort of how should you address that? I mean, there's sort of the democracy angle of like, well, the people there should have a say in it. but also the fairness to, you know, I'm first isn't the end. Do you have any thoughts on sort of how you would, how you address that, or how, I don't know, mm-hmm. how you can weigh those costs and benefits?
Right. So, I mean, as economists, we were sometimes taught to say that we don't make should statements.
Sure.
We only say what is and leave other people to make judgment calls.
Right.
But you and I are also very good at making judgment calls about things. We always have opinions about everything.
Yeah.
So we can do that. I think if left to their own devices, mm-hmm. people will buy and sell in a way that will make sense. Like if I have a neighbor who just isn't using their house, and somebody, that house would be really valuable to them, mm-hmm. they would offer money to that person in that house,
yeah.
and that transaction would take place.
Mm-hmm.
So when local governments are restricting, oh, this person who has a 2-acre farm, former farm, mm-hmm. They want to sell to a development, but mm-hmm. the people around them are like, oh, no, I only want one dwelling,
mm-hmm.
not a multifamily dwelling,
mm-hmm.
on this property.
Mm-hmm.
That's using the force of local government mm-hmm. to prevent a transaction that would be mutually beneficial from taking place. And
letting,
of course, there are spillover effects on the people around,
mm-hmm.
which is an economic challenge we call externalities.
Right.
But this is, you know, that's another thing to consider.
Sort of letting my opinions affect your property
mm-hmm.
and what you can do versus
right.
putting your money where your mouth is if you care so strongly about it. But.
Right, but we also have this sense that democracy, especially at the local level, makes things happen the way that the local people want. But
mm-hmm.
democracy is just 51%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in our neighborhood, we currently have a big hullabaloo about whether there should be a fine for not bringing your garbage can in the same day that there's garbage pickup. And,
right.
you know, some people are team, that's ridiculous. And some people are team, oh, we wouldn't want people to leave their garbage can out an extra day,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so it's not that everyone is of the same mind in a
right.
particular community when they get their local government to restrict building and things like that. And the big thing for economists is when you prevent building from taking place,
mm-hmm.
that people would want to have happen. How do we know they'd want to have it happen? People are willing to pay for that. When you restrict that, you're increasing the cost of housing and you're restricting the supply available
mm-hmm.
and, you know, preventing people from pursuing their own goals in the best way that they can. If we restrict people from entering
mm-hmm.
into North Carolina, which
mm-hmm.
is our biggest source of population growth,
right.
We're going to be cutting out the innovation, the economic benefit, as well as the, you know, amenities benefits of
right.
being around other people. You know, as much as we may complain about being around other people, in general, human beings right now tend to want to be around other people, both for economic reasons and for, you know, restaurants and social things and all of that.
Things that enrich enrich our lives.
That's right.
Well, thank you. This has been very, very informative and enlightening. Fun to talk to you about some of these things. And as we conclude, I wanted to say thank you to our audience for joining us. And thank you to Hannah for taking the time to do this episode for this episode and for this wonderful conversation. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and tell your friends that Conversatio is available on Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And until next time, God bless.